Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, what patients want doctors to know about facing death. The Journal of the American Medical Association recently published an opinion piece urging doctors and hospitals to focus on providing high-quality end-of-life care that's in line with what patients themselves want. The article said patients with advanced illness frequently receive care that is discordant from their personal preferences. Most people indicate that they would prefer to die at home, yet more than a fifth of patients still die in the hospital. But if patients are going to be more involved in determining their end-of-life care, doctors are going to have to figure out how to talk to them about it, and many doctors admit they're not prepared or trained for those discussions. As two physicians join us today, I think this is a chance as patients to consider what we want from doctors and how we should communicate better with doctors. Have you had a family situation where medical professionals didn't seem to hear or understand what was being said about a loved one's final days? Do you have a doctor with whom you can talk about this? So some of this is on the patient. We need to communicate more clearly and think about this with more clarity. But some of this is also on physicians and medical professionals. Have you had an opportunity, a situation that covers this in your own family where maybe the medical professionals really weren't hearing what was being said about a loved one's last days? And do you think you have a doctor with whom you can communicate clearly about this? Have you taken that opportunity? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can reach me on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Dr. Renee Critchlow is with us. She's a family doctor and assistant professor of family medicine at the U of M, and she's recorded some videos and talked about this in front of groups. So, Dr. Critchlow, really good to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Carrie. Good to be here.
Dr. Danielle Ofri is going to join us. She's the author of What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. We should be able to talk to her within a few minutes. Dr. Critchlow, I wonder if some of this lack of communication about this and the awkwardness and the fact that doctors aren't sure how to bring it up is because doctors fear that they will sound like they are encouraging the patient to make a rush decision or to go in one direction. You know, to try to be too influential in the decisions that the patient makes. Is that part of it, do you think?
Well, I definitely think that's part of it. And I think when we're in the situation and we're discussing end of life, and, you know, let's just use the word death, it's very challenging for physicians to go there if they haven't had the training. And it's sort of interesting because it's the one condition all of our patients will eventually have.
Right.
So it would be important for us to spend more time teaching people how to do this. All the studies have shown that people who have been given skills, physicians, nurses who have been given skills to have the conversations, feel more comfortable in bringing it up.
Dr. Ofri, you're there with us now?
Yes, I am.
You on the show. Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
So my outreach to listeners this morning is, as patients, let's consider what we want from our doctors. And as patients, let's think about, you know, our accountability in communicating around this. But you wrote a book called What Patients Say and What Doctors Hear. And I wonder if the gap between, you know, the communication on this is because you know, doctors feel like they don't know how to bring it up and patients aren't sure yet what we want from our doctors. Is there some of that going on?
There's always that. There's quite a gap between patients' priorities and doctors' priorities. The advice that I give to my students and residents is to really just start by asking questions. And the question I always begin with is, what do you understand thus far about your condition? Because you never know what the patients do or don't know. They may have some glaring misconceptions which you can clear up, or they may have a clear idea, but that helps you set the stage of where to begin.
That's good. That makes a lot of sense. To the phones here to Sherry in Minneapolis. Sherry, it sounds like you've been in this situation.
Yes, hi. I lost my elderly parents a few years ago, my father was 93 and had a failing heart valve. And a doctor suggested that he get a new valve. I had read the book Being Mortal and really had a chance. Because of the older generations really have a difficulty, I think, voicing their opinions. They're so respectful of physicians. And I was able to sort of bridge the gap and have a conversation with my dad about how he wanted the rest of his life to play out and what were the risks of the procedure. And he was able to say, no, I don't want this. So I think it's really important for family members to help make those conversations happen.
Sherry, really good point. And you're referencing us to Dr. Atul Gawande's book, Right Being Mortal. Dr. Critchlow, here's a really important inflection point right in this situation that Sherry's describing. The doctor is saying, we could put this valve in. Sherry is in that position of saying to her father, here's what all of this would mean. Take a look at that situation and tell me how you think the conversation should go from the doctor's perspective.
Well, this is, I think Sherry brings up a really interesting point. I'm imagining the person who was talking about the valve was a subspecialist, perhaps a CT surgeon or a cardiologist. These sort of end-of-life discussions, I really believe, should be spearheaded by your primary care doctor.
Uh-huh.
The idea that your general internist or your family physician knows you and has had conversations with you about what you want in your life. So it's like, what are your fears or worries about the future? And I really think, Dr. Lofi points out very well, what is your understanding of your illness? The idea that in American medicine, sometimes we think it's like we treat people like cars. We'll just replace the part and everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the way it goes. It's just like the morbidity, the life function, the quality of life that a lot of our interventions do to our patients, we have to take that into account. And we have to take into account that the fact that most people, when they're talking about their end of life, they want to be not a burden on their family. They want their family around. And, you know, they want freedom from discomfort. And the fact that we just keep treating people like mechanical things, just replacing parts, is not going to be helpful for cultivating the quality of life that people are looking for. So that's one of the things I think is really important, is having some level of continuity of care so that you can have a doctor who can take the information from the subspecialist and say, okay, sir, this is what they're saying. Mm. What is it that you're looking to do with your life?
Mm-hmm.
And I think family involvement is so critical. Right. Sherry's 100% right.
Call here from Anne in Shoreview. Hi, Anne. You've been through this yourself?
Yes. I guess my experience is as a primary doctor, we've gone through, I have a chronic condition. My children know exactly what my wishes are. I had an emergency situation, very serious, in a hospital situation, ER, and the specialist that was in to see me was following a script and asked me what my preferences were, end of life, basically, kind of within the script that mm-hmm. they have. And when I said no heroics, the doctor in the ER went pale and didn't know what to say to me. And didn't know how to proceed. And my son was there, and he said, then realizing that this doctor was extremely uncomfortable, did not know what to do, even though he was required to ask, and no coordination with the primary care physician during the whole event that I was hospitalized for 5 days with my primary doctor.
And you use the word script. When you say that, I mean, did you get the sense that the doctor was running down a list of questions, or what gave you the sense that he was following a script?
Yes, because it was totally out of context with the other questions that he was asking.
I see. Okay.
And, and he didn't make eye contact, and he seemed nervous about the question. And, and when you're dealing with a hospitalist, the hospitalists don't reach out to your primary care physician to see if any of this has been, dictated or gone through, or if anything's on file.
Okay. And if I may, two good things here. Dr. Ofri, what do you hear when Anne describes the questions didn't seem to make sense. He wasn't necessarily listening to the answers. What's going on there?
Well, a checklist is not a conversation, and there's a big difference. And often in medicine, when we need to solve a problem, we add a checklist or another field in the EMR to do in as though that will satisfy the mandate. But, of course, that only is giving lip service. And we have that with many things, domestic violence screening, depression screening. It's all motivated from a good spot, but the way it's carried out becomes more like a rote checklist. And, of course, each of these types of questions requires an in-depth conversation, which often is not appropriate at the moment you're in the emergency room or getting a medication refill. So we've gone a little bit backwards in approaching this.
And when I was talking to Dr. Critchlow about the general, you know, your own family doctor knows you best, I was also wondering, though, is it up to you to then, you know, coordinate that kind of connection between the people that are treating you for some crisis in the hospital and how to bring your GP in? What would you say?
Well, regretfully, we have a very disjointed medical system. I think in countries where there is a universal healthcare system and only one system, it runs much more smoothly. So anything you discuss with your primary care doctor is easily accessible to your hospitalist or specialist. In the United States, you know, things are really in different pieces in different places, and that doesn't always come through. So in the end, it does often fall to the patient and family to make sure these important priorities are conveyed.
Dr. Critchlow, this seems like a heavy lift. You know, you're in the middle of a crisis. The family's concerned about, you know, whether you're going to make it or not, and now you got to figure out how to connect the family physician to it.
Yeah, so I'm going to be really clear. We're very fortunate in Minnesota that we live in a state that has what's called a PULSED, which is a provider orders for sustaining end of life treatment, provider orders for life sustaining treatment. It's called a PULSED, and it's basically a form that you fill out in your clinic, typically, and sometimes folks that are in long term care fill it out there. But the whole idea is that it connects the conversations that are had in your primary care environment with what happens in the hospital. Basically, it's a physician order for life-sustaining treatment. You go down, this is one place where a checklist is helpful because you take the time to have the discussion in an outpatient visit and you express, and I always recommend when people do the PULSED that they bring family members into the discussion, they bring family members to the visit. And in that engagement with that form, we develop a very robust conversation that often I've seen family members say to each other, I didn't know that's the way you felt. I was unaware that that's what you wanted. Yes. And that's why I think the PULSED is really helpful. Two main reasons. It connects the discussions you've had with your primary with orders in the hospital. If Anne was lucky enough to discuss and had a PULSED, that would have been something that she would have just taken to the hospital and given it to them. And they would have been able to say, oh, you want these kinds of interventions, and we'll be able to put it in. Whereas what she went through was some poor ED doc doing the eventual, if something were to happen and you were unable to breathe on your own. And it's just right. This little, and it comes in just randomly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the PULSED is a very important way to begin the discussion with both your primary care doctor and your family, and it carries over into every emergency situation, and you have it before the crisis.
Conversation here with two physicians, Dr. Renee Critchlow and Dr. Danielle Ofri, about the conversations that physicians, if the numbers are right, the surveys are correct, if patients' own experiences are accurate, there's still a disconnect in so many relationships between patients and doctors, and having these discussions and in bringing clarity to the idea of how we'd like to die and how the medical professionals around us are listening to us and treating our wishes for that. I was quoting here in the introduction something from the Journal of American Medical Association that was saying that patients with advanced illness frequently receive care that's discordant from their personal preferences. Okay, think about what that means. We're talking about the implications of that with Renee and Danielle this morning. And I'm asking you as a patient, I think this is an opportunity for us to take some of this on, to be clear that we've thought about it and talked about it with our families. But what do you want from the medical professionals around you, your physicians, the nurses that may be treating you? 651-227-6000. And if you've been in a situation like this, maybe you've learned something about the difficulty of this or what worked well. That would be valuable too. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where a listener says it's a necessary three-way conversation between family, the care team, and the patient. Sometimes adult children and doctors want to save a patient at all costs, contrary to the patient's wishes. And these conversations often don't even involve the patient. Dr. Ofri, I know that puts a physician in a very difficult position. How to find your way through that? What would you say?
Well, I often begin by discussing healthcare proxy. I'll say to a patient, you know, if you were to be hit by the Second Avenue bus and couldn't speak, who in your family would be the person you'd want to speak in your voice? And that's a fairly easy question for patients to answer. And then I'll take the next step forward. Well, have you talked with them? You know, how would you feel about this, this, or that? You know, it's important that that person is not giving their opinion, but that person, their goal is to convey your opinion, and that you need to be in the director's chair the entire time, even if you can't communicate. Mm-hmm. So what are some things you would like that person to know? I mean, ideally, if that person could be present, but often in practice, they're not, if we don't have a designated session to talk about end-of-life preferences. But because often patients have not talked with their family at all about this and become as a surprise to family to hear what the person's wishes are.
Call from Kathleen in Grand Rapids. Hi, Kathleen. You've had a family situation where you've had to confront this, it sounds like.
Yes. My son was 7 and a half when he had a post-transplant relapse. My son had leukemia, and we had been working with this oncologist for 4 years by that time. And when the post-transplant relapse occurred, Bruce, Michael's doctor, came in and said, "Michael, your leukemia is back, and I'm afraid I can make it go away for a while, but I'm afraid I can no longer tell you that I can keep it away." And my son's response was, "I'm too young to die." And his doctor said, "You're right, Michael, you are." And then they talked a bit, and then Michael said, "I know God loves me, but it doesn't feel like it." And they talked some more, and his doctor stayed in with him for about 45 minutes, and they just talked. And that, of course, was the perfect way for a doctor to handle this. My daughter, on the other hand, had a brain tumor. Sorry, this one is more recent.
I am so sorry for your loss, Kathleen. Wow.
Yeah. So, we knew from the start it was a glioblastoma. We knew from the start that that was terminal. But we did go to see a specialist beyond her local oncologist because we were hoping that there would be some clinical trials that she might qualify for. And this specialist told us that no, there was nothing available because of the location of the tumor, et cetera, et cetera. She didn't qualify for any of the trials. And then he said to her, "It's really about facing your mortality." And I thought that was so harsh and so cruel. She knew and we knew that she was going to die, most likely going to die. It wasn't an issue of not facing her mortality. And I just thought,
I hear you, Kathleen. You've brought us two examples of very different ways that doctors handled this. Dr. Critchlow, what do you hear in the example with Kathleen's son and then the very different way that this was handled with her daughter?
Well, what I really hear with the first example, and I'm also very sorry for your loss. This sounds tragic. What I hear in the first example is a doctor that has either learned to or been trained to listen and speak empathetically. He heard what her son's fears were. Mm-hmm. and he addressed it. And it was very, he didn't run from it. He didn't put up his own defenses. He directly addressed it and said, yeah, you are too young to die. And that's a hard thing for someone to say.
Right.
But he was listening enough to know that that's what that child needed to hear. They needed to hear that he was being listened to and that his wishes were being taken into account. With the second example, what I'm hearing is a physician who is very defensive about death.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're hearing when they say things like that is their own fears. And those are things that with knowledge and skills can be improved. But yes, I'm very sorry that that happened with your daughter, because that was that own person's insecurity and defensiveness around death. And they were projecting it on the patient. And that's inappropriate.
You know, Dr. Ofori, I think that's exactly what patients fear, that there will be some kind of detachment out of genuine, as Renee is saying, out of genuine uncomfortable with this. I'm afraid to talk about death, so I don't know how to do this. But it's that detachment that is so painful. What do you say to medical students and other colleagues about this?
Well, first of all, I acknowledge that it is terrifying to talk about death. Nobody wants to talk about death, you know, not doctors, not nurses. I mean, who would really choose that? However, when patients are in that situation, they would rather talk about it than not talk about it. And so I think that we as physicians and nurses need to overcome our own issues. And again, if we shift the emphasis toward asking questions and asking, soliciting the patient's concerns and feelings, that will guide the conversation. We need to resist the urge to put in our own thoughts and philosophies and really focus on what the patients want. And so as Renee pointed out, listening is a much bigger part of the conversation than giving advice.
Danielle, I was reading the account of a physician. She wrote a book, I think, I can't remember the name of it, something about instant shock, or Dr. Rana Oddish, and she almost died when a benign tumor burst in her liver. She lost the child that she was pregnant with. She said the most powerful thing that she learned was that she wanted the medical staff. Now, here's a physician going through this. She wanted the medical staff to see her as a person with a lot of human dimension and not just a challenging or difficult case. And what she found was that's often how she was treated.
I find that very, very poignant. You know, there's a part of the medical interview called the, quote, social history.
Mm-hmm.
And often it comes down to, oh, does the patient smoke, drink, or take drugs? That's what my students will report. But in fact, the social history is really woven into the entire interview. Who is this person? Where are they from? When did they move here? Where do they live? Who do they live with? What do they do? What did they used to do?
Right.
What are their hobbies?
Right.
What's their circumstance? And I think the more we can emphasize that, besides just making medicine a more interesting field, it does give a context for a patient's illness, because the disease is the biological process, but is obviously more than that. And for each person, it's experienced quite differently. And so taking the extra time to get to know who this person is and their philosophy of life will come to light if you, you know, delve into their humanity, knowing their religion, how religious they are, if they are, where they gain support from in their life, what gives them pleasure and gratification. These things can help begin the more difficult conversations that will come.
Jessica says, my med student husband had his first patient pass away last week while rotating at HCMC. He asked the patient what they thought of the care plan, and they said impossible hope, which was hard for him to hear. They called in the palliative care team to support the process. To Simon in Grand Rapids. Hi, Simon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And just briefly, thanks to Kathleen for calling in there. That's their family. I know has been through a lot and appreciated her comments. I'm a paramedic, and one thing we see a lot, we show up to calls, and we'll hear, oh, this person's got a DNR order, which is a pulse, which one of your guests just referred to.
Rats.
It's amazing how often that isn't right there. It's not readily available, or it's not fully filled out, and people think they have it, and or they filled something else out. They don't quite understand. then it's a terrible situation, because without that right there in front of us, we are supposed to do everything. And we, believe me, the responders really don't want to. Nobody wants to put these people through it if everybody just wants to be left alone. But in the absence of properly and fully filled out paperwork, it's a problem. And it's amazing how often this even happens when a person lives in a long-term care facility and the facility staff just can't find the paperwork. Well, then as far as we know, as far as we have to be concerned in that moment, the paperwork doesn't exist. You know, and that just one other thing I'll add, and then I'll let you guests respond.
Okay.
Also, a lot of people have living wills filled out, advanced directive living wills, and those are good documents to have. And I won't quite get it. I won't take the time to explain exactly what that is and how it's different than a poll.
Yes.
But a lot of people don't understand that. They have living wills, and they think that that's a DNR order,
okay.
And it's not.
Renee, this is Simon, thank you. This is an opportunity to say, are there some documents that should be readily available? Renee, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. I was asking you whether you think there are some documents that could be readily available.
Yes.
If you're in a health crisis, yeah.
I think I tweeted you the Minnesota form.
Okay.
And for people who don't have access to that, you can literally just go online and to POLSP Minnesota, and multiple sites will come up that have the forms that you can download. You could also go to any of your primary care physicians and have the conversation, say, I want to fill out a pulse. And I think Simon brings up a really good point. It's like, this is not something that you want to just do halfway. You want to complete it, and it becomes an actual physician order. And so the paramedics have ways of engaging with it that allows them to fulfill your wishes.
Okay. I've retweeted that, Renee, and so you've included the link, and there's information on what that pulsed is. Renee Critchlow with us, physician, assistant professor of family medicine and community health at the U of M. Dr. Danielle Ofri with us, physician, author of several books, the most recent, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, talking about opening up these discussions with the medical community between patients, doctors, nurses, the medical community about what you want in these moments and months, perhaps, at the end of your life, how directive you can be and clear about how you think the end of your life looks. I have to say, I'm pretty startled to hear Renee and Danielle say that many people have never had this conversation with their families. So if there's one takeaway from this conversation this morning, it is to have this discussion with your family members. More discussion to come. 651-227-6000 from what you've learned in facing this within your own family. Questions about it, 800-242-2828. I'm going to get to Renee and Danielle on the other side of news here, too, about why, when many, many people would like to die at home, too many still end up dying in some kind of medical facility. So we'll talk about that on the other side of news. To Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. President Trump says his former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, is making up stories in order to get a deal. The president's tweet this morning comes after Cohen pleaded guilty to campaign finance charges in a case that poses a direct threat to Trump. Trump also mocked Cohen, saying if anyone is looking for a good lawyer, he would not recommend Cohen. Trump says he feels very badly for his former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. He was convicted yesterday of financial crimes. Wyoming voters have said no to President Trump's pick for governor. Secretary of State Mark Gordon, a rancher, has beaten political megadonor Foster Freeze in yesterday's GOP primary. A U.S. House race in Southern California could become suddenly competitive after Congressman Duncan Hunter and his wife were indicted on corruption charges. Hunter was strongly favored to hold the 50th Congressional District seat for the GOP, but the charges inject uncertainty into that race. Heavy rain, flash flooding, and high surf are threatening Hawaii's main islands, and residents are getting prepared. Hurricane Lane became a Category 5 storm last night with winds of at least 157 miles per hour. The National Weather Service's Central Pacific Hurricane Center expects Lane to move very close to over Hawaii from tomorrow through Saturday, and forecasters say even if Lane does not make landfall, the islands could be walloped with rain and wind. and hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees living in sprawling camps in Bangladesh are celebrating the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha, praying for better lives as they wonder if they will ever again celebrate at their homes in Myanmar. More than 700,000 Rohingya poured into Bangladesh last year, fleeing a scorched earth campaign by the Myanmar military and Buddhist monks. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:36.
We're covering a lot of information in this show about end of life and decision making and discussions with physicians. If you've gotten in late, you can find the show, listen to it at your leisure when you have a moment to focus on it. Find it in the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen to podcasts.
Programming is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping public radio advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. Knight Foundation believes informed and engaged communities are essential for healthy democracy. More at knightfoundation.org.
Tomorrow morning at the Minnesota State Fair, Ken Rudin, the political junkie, in town at 9 o'clock. We're going to talk about, oh my gosh, all the politics swirling around out of Washington and here in Minnesota, campaigning, fundraising, all those issues. And then at 10, it is Minnesota political trivia with maybe some national trivia thrown in there, too. And Ken is bringing goodies for everyone. So I hope you'll be out there at this opening day of the Minnesota State Fair. Back to our discussion now. Dr. Renee Critchlow with us from the U of M. Dr. Danielle Ofri with us, author of What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. Dr. Ofri, before we take some more calls, I wanted to ask you about something that you wrote recently about why patients and doctors often don't die at home as they'd like to. And you said, most doctors I know have been seared by the experience of witnessing the modern way of death in the hospital. With improvement in care, some deaths can be peaceful, but the vast majority are anything but. Most of us came out of residency committed to holing up at home with a morphine drip when the end is approaching, barricading the door against the medical profession. Oh my gosh, explain that.
Well, I think after you've been through your residency training, which you spend an excess amount of time in the intensive care unit, in the acute care wards, and you see really death at its worst, although occasionally you see incredible saves and you see technology do amazing things. But the honest truth is, more often than not, we've just prolonged the suffering. So most of us come out of this saying we never want that at all. Unfortunately, the reality is that it can be often quite difficult to die at home. And people need someone to do the care, the often 24-hour care. Mm-hmm. And if there's not a family member who's able to, which is, you know, if you think about it, quite a bit to ask, someone has to quit their job or, you know, be a full-time caregiver, because often insurance does not cover 24-hour care. So the logistics can make it very, very difficult, unfortunately, for families to achieve this.
I see. What about bringing hospice in, Renee? Isn't that really what hospice is for, or is that only for a limited amount of time?
Well, I, as you know, am a big fan of hospice. And mm-hmm. I think one of the very big differences in different specialty trainings, in family medicine, we do spend times in the ICU, but we also spend, especially as they go for their second and third year, almost 50% of their time with their outpatient panels in clinic, talking to the people that they care for both in the hospital and outside of the hospital. So you're in a situation where you understand that having the conversations as an outpatient is very important, and bringing hospice in early as a conversation. If you look, the majority of American adults have some sort of chronic illness, and a significant number, about 25% actually have, 25 to 40% have multiple chronic illnesses. And their decline is not as rapid as we always think about it.
I see.
The last 3 years of most of the Medicare population's lives are where they spend a significant amount of their dollars. And it's because in those situations, you can see that there is a decline that's coming. As a primary care doctor, I am able, perfect example, one of my patients this last year had end-stage chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And I've known him for 7 years. Mm-hmm. And he's just one of the biggest curmudgeons ever. And he was a funny, grumpy guy. And at one point, I just said, you know what? This is where we are. And this is not going to get better. What is it that's important to you? Mm-hmm. And he said, the most important thing to me is that I get to drive. And I was like, okay, is that what keeping you out of hospice? He's like, yes. I said, okay, so this is what we'll do. We'll work out with hospice that you'll have one day every 10 days where you're not on any medication and you can go around the block with your car. And he said, yeah, I'll do it. And he spent 7 months in hospice where the actual, you know, average of stay is like 29 days.
I see.
His family had support, both physical and mental. And he was comfortable the last 7 months of his life. People are often afraid that hospice is giving up.
Right.
We try to teach that it's shifting your care to one of comfort and quality, as opposed to just constantly trying to extend. And we have to decide if we're prolonging a quality life or we're prolonging death. Hospice allows you to have the comfort for both you and your family.
Leslie says, as a hospice social worker, I'm continually surprised at how ill-prepared people are for end of life. In reality, there's a lot of gray area in end-of-life choices, much more than whether or not a person wants life support. The onus lies with doctors and patients. To Victor in Plymouth. Hi, Victor. Thanks so much for waiting. You're a physician? You deal with these questions, it sounds like.
Right. I'm the co-chair of the Minnesota Pulse Task Force, and the Pulse has been brought up a lot.
Yeah.
And a little bit of, I'm a concern that the audience may misunderstand it. The audience was encouraged to download the Pulse.
Oh, yeah.
I want to make it clear that the Pulse is really a set of medical orders, and it should only be filled out in conjunction with the provider, a physician or a nurse that's trained to have a discussion with the patient about the various medical options. Patients really should not fill these out on their own. They're intended for people only with serious chronic illness, such as metastatic cancer or congestive heart failure, that have a poor prognosis, but they really should be filled out with sitting down with a doctor or a trained nurse who understands the options so patients can fill these out correctly. Patients shouldn't feel they can fill these out and have them at home and that they're going to be followed by EMS providers, because they won't be unless they're signed by a provider.
Okay, I have to, Renee, come back in here because you were recommending this. I have to say, thought that that's what you did. You had the packet of papers, you filled it out, and it was ready to go. Okay.
As I put in the tweet, this is about the reason you would be able to download this is to start the conversation. And I said, start the conversation with your family, and then it has to be filled out and signed by the physician in the clinic. So I hope that wasn't a misunderstanding.
No, that might have been mine. Yeah.
Yeah. I do think downloading it and having the conversation with your family is important, so that the first time you talk about these things, it's not when you're in your 20-minute visit with your doctor. You need to have these conversations before then so that you can fully engage with your physician. And fully engaging with your physician, making your choices known, then they fill out the official form. Doctor signs it, you sign it, and it becomes a physician order. So, sir, I'm sorry if that was misunderstood.
No, I think that was me. Victor, do you find overall that many doctors still hesitate to, initiate these discussions if the patient hasn't brought it up?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the literature shows that 80% of patients expect doctors to initiate these discussions, and 80% of physicians expect the patients to initiate the discussion. So consequently, many times the discussions just don't take place until the patient's in the hospital dealing with a hospitalist that they've never met before. And that's very unfortunate, because I agree with the doctors that have spoken that the best doctor to have this discussion is the primary care doctor who's had a relationship with the patient.
Got it.
And as the doctors have said, physicians aren't trained to have these discussions, and we really need to do an enormous amount of work to get physicians trained up to have these conversations in a compassionate way, because that wasn't part of our medical training, sadly.
But you think it is? I mean, maybe I should come back to Danielle on this. Is this being incorporated more into medical school student training?
It's beginning to, but I wanted to add that partly the system doesn't really allow for this. Again, at maximum, you'll have a 20-minute visit, and these patients have many active medical issues that need to be dealt with in the immediate term. So there often isn't time to do this. If you need to adjust someone's insulin and their medications and refill all their medications, order their labs, take care of all these things. It really does more than fill the visit, including the excessive documentation that we have. So it's hard to find dedicated time to have this discussion, which can take a long time if you do it well. And partly that's because we don't consider that, quote, part of medical care. It's not often reimbursed by insurance companies. The last time we tried to do this on a national level, it was derided as death panels.
Right.
But in fact, most patients would like dedicated time. And I believe most doctors would like dedicated time to discuss this.
You know what? I wondered from both of you whether you think the advent of more states passing and debating this medical aid in dying, I think Oregon, Washington State, Vermont, California, Montana have all passed this, may open up more of these conversations. Renee, I don't know if Minnesota's, you know, when and if Minnesota's going to get to this, but I wonder if just the debate around this as a political issue means it might start more discussions.
Yeah, I really think it will, because I think it actually is a symptom of the fact that we don't do this well. Patients, they don't want discomfort. They don't want to be a burden on their family. And they're looking at the medical assisted dying as a way out. If people are in those situations, hospice can address a lot of those issues. And I think the advent of these new laws is just the hallmark of the fact that we are doing a very bad job of having these discussions. And we really, you're absolutely right. We need to bring these discussions into the medical school, into the residency. We started, but medicine has been for a very long time an apprentice profession. I mean, most of us learned how to deal with end-of-life discussions from our senior residents who was doing it while we were either in medical school or in residency.
Oh.
I remember we had one young kid who I was an intern, and I had fourth-year medical student, and we had this basically a child that we were coding and eventually died. And I remember looking up at this medical student and seeing his face, and he was devastated. It was the first time he'd ever seen a death, and it was a child.
Wow.
And I just went up to him. I'm the intern. I said, hey, let's go get some ice cream. And we stepped out, and he just burst into tears. And I was like, no one has taught us how to deal with this. I was like, I was the intern, and I'm teaching a fourth-year medical student. This has to be an integral part of our education. Because as I said, this is the one condition we know all of our patients are going to eventually have. And we need to be able to deal with it better. Or people are going to want to just, honestly, just be assisted in their diet.
Right.
And that's, I think, a little scary.
Danielle, I know you've been candid about kind of pivotal moments in your medical career where maybe you didn't handle it like you wish you had. You learned from it. Can you share one of those?
Well, there are so many. I recall a patient whose death went so quickly, and I remember that the spouse said to me, you know, I didn't know the end when it came would come so fast, that we weren't ready for that. And that really stuck with me, that we as a team hadn't really prepared them for the speed of decline and then how many things would have to take place during those final, you know, days or weeks. And we'd been so focused on the act of treatment, we hadn't really prepared the family for what it would be like. And that's now changed how I practice. And even technical things like sharing passwords for the bank, giving over documents that the surviving spouse will need to handle things. So all of these logistical parts are as important, because the as has been said, patients don't want to burden their families, and especially with the logistics of death, which are enormous. And imagine in your grief, you also have to handle bank accounts and telephone statements and all of these accounts and emails that need to be changed. So helping patients think about these things way in advance is something patients very much want.
Patty called from New Brighton to say, I want to commend physicians and nurses who took care of my wife at the end of her life. 2 years ago, she was given so much information. Her doctor was direct and listened. She advocated very strongly for herself. We had the best support possible. It's good to hear. Patricia says on Twitter, I'm a nurse. I was my mother's hospice nurse. All of these experiences made me have this conversation with my eldest 18-year-old daughter, who is moving in tomorrow into college. It's as simple as what your wishes would be. And to Zach in Minneapolis, hi, Zach. You come at this from an interesting profession as a hospital chaplain, yes?
Yeah, thank you, Carrie. Yeah, I'm a board-certified hospital chaplain. And so in the intensive care unit and in the ER, both places I've worked, I see what happens when people have not had the tough conversations that we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the support of the hospital system that I worked for, I've actually created a new nonprofit that does exactly this, that helps people not just start the conversation, but explore all the aspects of it, medical, psychosocial, logistical, document them, and then share them with both their medical team and with their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody's interested, the website is allaycare.org, A-L-L-A-Y, care.org, and we'd love to hear from you.
Okay. Zach, thanks. Thanks for the work. To Tara in northern Minnesota. Hi, Tara. Thank you. Thanks very much for calling in.
Hi. So I was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer, and my care team, we had this conversation about my end-of-life decisions,
mm-hmm.
and then I also, you know, made all the arrangements for funeral, memorial service, just my wishes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my father, who had congestive heart failure, he had cardiomyopathy. I don't believe any of his doctors ever talked to him about this subject. And he unexpectedly passed away. He had no wishes written down, no living will, nothing. And then family started to bicker between themselves about what should be done for the funeral, what he should wear, you know, in the casket. And it was just very disheartening. And I wish somebody would have had that same conversation with him, because his condition was just as fatal as my condition is. But because it's stage 4 cancer, they have it, you know, they have the pamphlet, they have a book for you.
Right.
To deal with the end of life.
You know,
and I think that people should have this conversation. It's hard, but everybody's going to die. And you don't want your family fighting at the worst time of their life.
I'm really glad for your call, because you raised a question that I wanted to get to and I forgot about it, which is the role, Renee and Danielle, of children. I mean, Tara has, you know, been forward looking on this for herself. But what if, you know, what if there has never been discussion within the family with aging parents about this? You want to begin this. How do you do it?
Yeah, I can reinforce that. I've admitted people in the hospital in their 90s and asked them the end of life, you know, DNR, DNI question. They're like, oh, I've never thought about that. And I'm like, you are 92 years old. And this is a conversation that I believe, honestly, family gatherings. There's a lot of people who say, you know, Thanksgiving, take 30 minutes and just say, you know, I need you guys to know about how I want my man's life to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows people to, when they're in the situation and it's the crisis, it allows them to say, I am going to do my father's wishes. I may not agree with this, but I know my father's wishes because we've had this conversation.
Right.
I think family gatherings are a very good time. Adult children, you know, once your child's over 18, they're considered an adult child. They often will be the people who are making the decisions when you can't make the decision. It's the loving thing for a parent to do is to give their adult child the opportunity and the information to help them at the end of their life. And I think that that is something. It's one of the best things, one of the best gifts you can give your adult child as a parent. It's like, these are my wishes. You don't have to make the decisions. I've made the decisions. I just need to make sure that you understand them and help them get carried out.
Danielle, my family has always been weirdly open about this. I mean, open conversation for years about what everybody wants and what this is going to be like. What do you do if your parents are closed you know, to this discussion?
Well, as a physician, I try to ask the patient if they don't want to talk about it with their children to at least tell me as their doctor, and I'll document that in the chart what they've expressed to me. I'll also ask them, you know, of your children, is there one person you want to designate as a spokesperson? And if they can at least say that, that can help minimize the bickering if someone's already been designated. And again, as Renee said, I try to portray it as the gift you give your children as much as you can. And then sometimes there are families for which, you know, it's not possible. Also, we've talked a lot about when you have your regular family doctor, many patients do not have a regular doctor and don't have someone who's a consistent nurse or doctor in their life. Right. And so it's often left to the inpatient team, the ICU team, the hospitalist, the chaplain. It's less than ideal, but that's often, you know, what happens.
Katie says on Twitter, I've had three family members pass away over the last several months, all relying on various levels of hospice care near the end. This care has been a lifesaver for our family during an otherwise overwhelming time. Thanks for covering the topic. And last call here from Teresa in Blaine. Hi, Teresa.
Hello. I just wanted to make a point about the palliative care and hospice
sure.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
My dad actually had a stroke, and he could not speak after the stroke. And so we have I have four other siblings, and my mother is still alive as well. And so we had a really hard time because he had never really expressed any of his wishes to any of us, aside from he told me he didn't want to be hooked up to tubes. And so when we got to that point, we found that the entire family was on a completely different page on what to do with him. And because the emotions were running high, and also the younger siblings didn't really want to accept the fact that he was going to pass away. And so we left him on life support for the next 16 months. And unfortunately, you know, we finally came to the conclusion that with use of palliative care and hospice, he was in a nursing home. We had both of them on board, and with palliative care's help, they finally got my sibling to realize that, hey, he is going to die from this, and they got him to accept it and said, okay, we're going to go DNR on him now at this point. So it's very important to have those discussions with your children prior to that, as well as getting those documents in place so that when something does happen, they will know.
Teresa, thanks. And you've emphasized, I think, my other takeaway on this is if you don't have these conversations, you know, you're opening yourself up to a lot of difficult discussions among the family members, and nobody wants to have to deal with that at that moment. Renee, Danielle, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you.